Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Uganda has declared the end of the Ebola disease outbreak less than 4 months after the first case was confirmed in the country's central Mubende district in September. This outbreak has been caused by the Sudan Ebola virus, one of 6 species of the Ebola virus. This was the country's 5th infection with the Sudan virus. 164 people have been infected, 55 have died, and 87 patients recovered, according to the World Health Organization. WHO says, among other things, Ugandan health authorities have implemented accelerated public health actions, and people in the hotspot communities of Mubende and Kasanda experienced restricted movements. Health authorities are maintaining surveillance to address any flare-ups. For more insight, I spoke with Dr. Otim Patrick Ramadan, Health Emergency Officer at the WHO Regional Office for Africa, and asked his reaction.
Well, my reaction is one of a big relief because this outbreak had the potential to escalate because, one, it was reported a little bit late from the community to the health facility, and we had cases reported in big cities of Kampala and Jinja, as well as the increased movement between countries within the sub-region. So we had a risk for major escalation. So it's a big relief that now the end of the outbreak has been declared.
So what did it take to get to this point? Because as you said, it's been challenging for the country, and also partners were supporting, such as WHO. What did it take to get to this result?
I think first and foremost was a very strong and decisive leadership, both at the political level and also at a technical level from the Ministry of Health. So the leadership was very, very important. The second one was partnership. So we had a very open and transparent partnership between the Ministry of Health and us from the international community, as well as the local partners that worked together from the community level up to the national level to ensure that we deliver a coherent response. The third one then was we had evidence-based use of public health interventions. You know that for this particular species of the virus, we did not have a vaccine or therapeutic, but we used known and trusted public health measures such as case investigation, contact tracing, infection prevention and control, and community engagement. All these were used based by the epidemiological data to inform the response. And then lastly was the community ownership and participation. So right from the initial cluster in Mubende up to the rest of the districts that were affected, the communities were very, very much cooperative and involved in the response. So those were very key factors in attaining this success.
This latest outbreak in the country was the 5th one caused by the Sudan strain of the Ebola virus. How much of a concern is this as particular strain compared to the Zaire strain that the DRC, for example, has been experiencing? And what are some of the lessons learned this time around?
Thank you. Yes, we totally agree that this particular outbreak due to the Sudan species of the Ebola virus was of a big concern, because in the last 10 years, we have made significant progress in terms of controlling the Ebola Zaire, which has been happening in DRC, but also happened in West Africa in 2014 and 2015. And we have developed effective vaccines that are now being deployed, as well as treatments in terms of monoclonal antibodies. So we did not have the advantage of these medical countermeasures against the Sudan species. So we were very worried then that we will struggle to contain the spread because the vaccine is not effective, but also we will have a high case fatality rate because we do not have monoclonal antibodies and other therapeutics that can be used to manage patients. So those were the big concerns that we had. Now, in terms of the lessons learned, I think the first lesson is that we have once again seen that even in the absence of vaccine, we are able to stop transmission of a highly infectious virus like Ebola, just using the non-public health measures that have worked previously. The second one also that despite the fact that we didn't have a therapeutic agent that is approved for this species, we were able to save a number of lives. One, by early presentation at the treatment centers, and two, by aggressive provision of supportive care. So you will notice that over 80 patients recovered after having received treatment in the different treatment centers across the country. And then lastly is also the issue of the role of the community in public health measures. If the community did not support us and participate and actively own the response, I think we would have struggled. And so it's a very big lesson that we should always work with the communities in these types of public health responses.
Speaking of the communities, when there is an outbreak of Ebola, so what we've seen in the past is the fact that, for example, the patient zero was maybe in contact with an animal and everything. So what do you say in terms of the role of the community, even in the prevention process? What is your message?
So we always say that the outbreak starts in the community and ends in the community. So the role of the community in prevention is very, very central. The first person, usually patient zero, as you mentioned, that comes in contact with a wild animal or so and brings this into the community, and then the transmission is amplified by the fact that we care for our sick people, we care for somebody who has even died, we participate in the funeral, and this amplifies the transmission. Now, once this has been identified as an Ebola and the message is passed to the community to avoid the behaviors, the risky behaviors that favor transmission, their cooperation and uptake of these measures is very, very important in stopping the transmission. One of the most difficult things we always ask the communities is to stop burying their loved ones and allow us to do this in line with the infection prevention and control measures. That means that for some religions that believe in washing their dead bodies, they cannot be able to do that. In people who believe in having 3 days of vigil around the dead body, they cannot do that. So those are very difficult asks that we make to the community. And in this particular context, we had some small challenges here and there, but largely the community cooperated with us in avoiding those risky behaviors. And also people reduced their movements, especially out of the epicenters, and this reduced on the risk of spread from the epicenter to other districts.
Now, a trial is underway to develop a vaccine specific to the Sudan Ebola virus, as you mentioned. How much of a game changer is it to prevent new outbreaks?
So this will be a very big game changer if we get a vaccine that is effective against the Sudan species. As we have seen with the Ebola Zaire, once we had a vaccine that is available, this vaccine, we have proactively deployed it in areas where we have risks of an outbreak starting, and even vaccinated health workers. Last year, we had one case of an Ebola outbreak in Beni, and the patient was in a health facility where the healthcare workers had already been vaccinated. So the transmission did not take place from that patient to the healthcare workers because they were protected. And we stopped a very big explosive outbreak from happening. So having a similar vaccine for the Sudan species will really, really help in stopping that such kinds of outbreaks from happening. But also it will help in reducing, once an outbreak has happened, the vaccine is deployed to vaccinate the contacts and their contacts. And this also reduces the further spread and helps us to stop the outbreak much quicker. Like we had with the recent outbreak in DRC that only took us over 30 days to contain.
And what are the WHO's recommendations to ensure that communities are protected in the future against the Ebola virus and countries in general? What does surveillance look like?
So Ebola is one of the zoonotic diseases, and zoonotic means then it originates from animals and then it jumps to humans. So one of the central tenets of preventing and protecting the communities is continuous health education for communities, especially in our areas where we have people who eat bush meat and then who also go hunting, to really educate them in terms of the risks associated with getting this meat from animals that are sick or animals that have died of unknown causes. So that health education is a continuous process that communities have to receive. The second one then is also in terms of enhancing surveillance. surveillance at three levels. One is at the community level, what we call the community-based surveillance, so that when there is any cluster of case of illness or deaths at the community, it is promptly detected and reported to health authorities for action. The second level of surveillance then is in the hospitals, both private and public, so that if a patient presents with symptoms that are suggestive of a viral hemorrhagic fever, that it can be detected quickly and samples collected for confirmation. The third level of surveillance is what we call the ecological surveillance, which requires a one health approach, working with the animal health and also the environmental colleagues to be able to map out what are the different species of viruses that are circulating in each area, and then we can be able to plan mitigations. Lastly, also is the issue of ensuring that we invest in research that maps out the distribution of the viruses, research that also contributes to generation of new vaccines. Like we have other viruses now for which we don't have vaccines. Sudan virus is one, the Marburg virus is another one. And then also research that funds generation of therapeutics, effective antivirals and effective monoclonal antibodies against this particular species. So these are very key in ensuring that collectively we contribute to protection of communities against not only Ebola, but also other zoonotic diseases.
Let me ask you your thoughts on this. You know, when people hear about Ebola, the first reaction is very often fear. Africa is dealing with outbreaks, recurring diseases, and is endemic to diseases like malaria and everything. So what do you have to say when it comes to Ebola, that people will still have this very big concern and we still will be seeing outbreaks of Ebola, it seems like? Is Ebola a part of life? What is the message really around Ebola? Because it's a very scary disease.
Yes, I agree that Ebola is very scary in two terms. One is that it is highly transmissible. It can easily spread from one person to the other. Second one is then that once people get infected, the case fatality ratio is very high. For the Sudan Ebola species that we just dealt with, it ranges from 44% to over 100%. And for the Zaire Ebola species, the case fatality ranges from above 50 to 100. So that's a lot of people dying. So it's a disease that invokes a lot of emotions because of the sheer number of people that die. However, when we look at it in the context, it's a rare occurrence. It doesn't happen as frequent like other public health issues. Like you have mentioned, malaria, for instance, is endemic in most of the countries and has been going on for a long time. So one of the things that we really encourage is that, one, for diseases that are highly epidemic prone like Ebola, that we continue to have sensitive surveillance systems in countries that they can be able to detect. We can never say when any new disease or even an outbreak of known diseases will happen. But if we have better systems that can detect and respond quickly and contain, then we are much more prepared. As the human population increases and also industrialization, urbanization, agricultural activities, the interaction between us, the humans, and then the animals and the viruses that are circulating among the animals increases, we are most likely to get some of these jumps of viruses from the animals to humans. So we should be better prepared in terms of surveillance systems, laboratory capacities, and hospital capacities to manage these cases such that we respond effectively. And the populations should always report such kinds of diseases to the health facilities so that response is done effectively. And that is really my main message.
That was Dr. Otim Patrick Ramadan, Health Emergency Officer at the WHO Regional Office for Africa, speaking to us from Brazzaville in Congo. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices. Our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. The UN's Children's Agency, UNICEF, has handed over life-saving supplies worth about $300,000 to support Malawi's fight against a cholera outbreak, which has killed more than 700 people, including 104 children, since the outbreak began in March of last year. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
The supplies include acute watery diarrhea kits, high-performance stents, antibiotics, and other medicines and medical supplies. The donation follows Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera's December 5 declaration of a public health emergency and appeal for local and international support in the fight against the cholera outbreak. Rudolf Schwenk is the country representative for UNICEF in Malawi.
We will continue to support the Ministry of Health to scale up the cholera response. And we fully appreciate the tireless efforts from frontline health and community workers to manage the influx of cholera cases. With more than 6,200 children already affected and more than 100 deaths, the spread of this outbreak is a threat to the health and well-being of children.
UNICEF says it secured the supplies and chartered a special flight to Malawi with support from the European Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations. Statistics from the Public Health Institute of Malawi show that as of Thursday, the disease had killed 773 people, including 104 children, and resulted in 23,217 cases since the outbreak started in March last year. Maziko Matemba is Community Health Ambassador in Malawi. He says the supplies come at a time when Malawi is in critical need of them.
This call upon on government and its key stakeholders to find a mechanism on how to prepare emergency of this nature, because they will be keep on coming.
Cholera is an acute diarrheal infection caused by ingesting food or water contaminated with bacteria. The disease affects both children and adults, and if untreated, can kill within hours. The Malawi Ministry of Health says the fatality rate of the outbreak is now at 3.33%, much higher than the recommended 1% global threshold. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
We turn now to malaria. Get this, 247 million people suffered from malaria in 2021. That's an increase of 2 million cases from 2020, according to the WHO's World Malaria Report 2022 release in December. 619,000 people lost their lives to the mosquito-borne disease. Most of them were children under 5 in sub-Saharan Africa. Observers say the increase in infection and mortality rate is partly attributed to the COVID-19 pandemic, the threats of drug and insecticide resistance, and the growing funding gap in the fight against malaria. I spoke with Dr. Corinne Karema, interim CEO of the RBM Partnership, who shared some of the pressing needs in the fight against malaria. Take a listen.
The fights against malaria remain precarious, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where the malaria burden remains very high. We are seeing more insecticide and drug resistance. There is, of course, the COVID impact that has affected and disrupted the malaria services. And there is also limited funding that is posing an added challenge to the disease control efforts. So in terms of the numbers, when we look at the WHO World Malaria Report of 2021, so there were 214 million malaria cases and 627,000 lives were lost to malaria, which is an increase of 69 deaths compared to the year before.
Recently, there was a result of a clinical trial that was conducted in Burkina Faso with the Oxford University research in partnership with researchers in Burkina Faso that found that a vaccine against malaria was efficacious for at least 80%, 85%, I believe. What is your reaction when you see this kind of research, this kind of findings in terms of the impact, the future impact of malaria control?
We are grateful We are seeing new and innovation tools like the vaccine. We are seeing many vaccine candidates for malaria. We are also seeing a new generation of mosquito nets that are being developed and showing that they can protect and prevent malaria in area where we have insecticide resistance. I see we have a lot in terms of innovation in the pipeline. So this is really great. But we also need to use well the resources that are available. So we have seen there are many countries now, we have 25 countries that are eliminating malaria. They've used the existing tools. We have hope. We are seeing their countries and with the innovation that we have in pipeline, as well as the gene drive, the mosquito genetically modified, those are really innovation that are also going to be added to the existing tools and combined together can help us to reach our targets to end malaria.
When will we see the end of malaria?
It's not acceptable to die from malaria today, because this is a preventable and treatable disease. So for us to stay ahead of the challenges and ultimately end malaria, we need, first of all, to use correctly the available resources, use data to target the hard-to-reach population, and also tailor our intervention based on the malaria transmissions, and then funding also, more funding for us. And those are the most three important, in addition to the strong health system, to help us to end malaria for good.
And finally, what are some current priorities for the RBM partnership?
The RBM partnership will continue to work to keep malaria high on global health and political agenda, particularly to mobilize more resources, more partners, and galvanize commitment from government and the private sector, and by promoting a multilateral response to malaria elimination. So we will continue to work with governments and partners across the world to mobilize resources, and this is invested to maximum effect by, first of all, facilitating sharing of quality data to drive better decision making, transparency, as well as accountability. Second, to support countries, of course, to optimize the quality and effectiveness of their malaria program. And then the last one is to support the deployment and scale up of new malaria tools, all the innovation and approaches.
That was Dr. Corinne Karima, Interim CEO of the RBM Partnership, speaking to us. A new report says at least 5 million children died before they reached their fifth birthday, and another 2.1 million children and youth lost their lives in 2021. But there is some good news in the UN report. The under 5 mortality rate decreased worldwide by more than a third. Lou Weyperson, UNICEF Associate Director of Maternal, Newborn, Child and Adolescent Health, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that UN humanitarian groups were able to cut the child mortality rate in half from where it was two decades ago. Still, Pearson says much more needs to be done to reduce child mortality.
Yeah, it is progress, but not enough, right? Even one death is too many. One unnecessary, one preventable death is too many for the family and for the world. Most of the under five deaths happen in low-income countries. And in particular, there are 38 countries experiencing acute humanitarian situations, account for the majority of the mortality. These countries include Yemen, and the northern part of Nigeria, and Ethiopia in the past few years, and Somalia, and Afghanistan. So these countries need to make faster progress if we want to make move the needle of the world. If we use under five mortality reduction as a tracer indicator, that many countries, But in particular, those countries are lacking progress, needs to move faster.
Those countries that you mentioned that include a lot of African countries, there have been conflicts and intercommunal fighting. Is that the main reason of the child mortality?
Also natural disasters, as well as huge public health emergencies. If you look at DR Congo, a big country with rich natural resources, but it's also a country experiencing what we call multi-pandemic, that they have had Ebola and COVID-19, cholera, measles, polio outbreaks. So all these health emergencies also affect the delivery of routine health programs, especially at last mile. If you look at the mortality rate within the country, there are huge variations in different geographic zones. In the rich urban areas, the mortality rate is much lower than remote rural areas, and the urban poor and areas affected by acute conflict. So what we are looking at is not just the global average or national average. It's really important to look into more nuanced analysis to understand where exactly within the country that more actions are needed.
As you mentioned at the top, the goals have actually, some have been attained, that you have reduced significantly the number since 2010. Where do you attribute that to? What kinds of areas that the UN and other groups, humanitarian groups, where did you target your efforts that made those numbers come down?
So first of all, we need to look at what caused those under five mortalities, what killed the children. So these are, half of them are due to newborn complications. Around 50% of the 5 million happens in the first 28 days. This newborn period is the most risk for children. They are linked with maternal health, obstetric care, and then pneumonia, diarrhea, malaria, TB, HIV, and many other conditions contribute to the majority of them under 5 days.
Thus, Louis Pearson, UNICEF Associate Director of Maternal, Newborn, Child, and Adolescent Health. She was speaking to my colleague from UN headquarters in New York. We turn now to the coronavirus pandemic. China has reported huge rise in COVID-related deaths recently. Take a listen.
Nearly 60,000 people with COVID have died in hospital since China abruptly dismantled its zero COVID policy in early December, a steep increase from previously reported figures that follows global criticism of the country's coronavirus data. Between December 8 and January 12, the number of COVID-related deaths in Chinese hospitals totaled 59,938, with an average age of 80.3 among the deceased. Jiao Yawi, an official from the National Health Commission, told a news conference on Saturday. Of the patients who died, 90.1% were aged 65 and older. Despite the numbers, Jiao also said that COVID fever and emergency hospitalizations have peaked in China, and that the number of hospitalized patients is continuing to decline.
The ratio of people who have tested positive at fever clinics is also declining steadily, peaking at 33.9% on December 20th and is down to 10.8% on January 12th. This trend indicates that the peak of fever clinics has passed.
Authorities had been reporting five or fewer deaths a day over the past month, figures that seem inconsistent with the long queues seen at funeral homes and the body bags seen leaving crowded hospitals. While international health experts have predicted at least 1 million COVID-related deaths this year, China had previously reported just over 5,000 since the pandemic began, one of the lowest death rates in the world.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu, in Washington. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.